weekday mornings from the 2012 Edinburgh Festival on Radio 3 from 11 o'clock.
And Radio 3 is on 90 to 93 FM on digital radio and online. It's a tad after 1 o'clock, time for the news from Lerpa Qatari.
Head teachers say they're not ruling out the possibility of legal action over this year's GCSE results. The National Association of Head Teachers says it's been inundated with telephone calls from schools concerned that many pupils didn't get the grades they'd expected in English. The Association of School and College Leaders said grade boundaries were moved up between January and June, meaning papers were marked more harshly in the summer. The government has rejected claims that there was any political pressure on exam boards to mark pupils more harshly. The Korean firm Samsung is to appeal against a ruling by a US court that it infringed several patents belonging to its main rival, Apple. Samsung was ordered to pay damages of £665 million for copying the iPad and iPhone design. A tropical storm close to hurricane strength has reached the southern coast of Haiti, around 60 miles west of the capital, Port-au-Prince. The arrival of the tropical storm Isaac has raised fears for hundreds of thousands of people who remain homeless following the earthquake there 2 years ago. The Greek Prime Minister Antonis Samaras and the French President François Hollande have insisted Greece must remain in the Eurozone following talks in Paris on the Greek financial crisis. Mr. Samaras is trying to negotiate more time to implement the cuts demanded by EU countries in return for bailout funds. The BBC has been told that an attack by a US drone aircraft in Pakistan last week killed a senior militant commander from the so-called Haqqani network. The death near the Afghan border has not been confirmed by NATO or Pakistani officials. Several British Olympic medalists are being honoured with homecoming parades. 19-year-old Jade Jones, who is Team GB's youngest medalist, will take part in an open-top bus parade in her hometown of Flint this afternoon. Britain's Olympics rowers are attending a reception in Henley-on-Thames. And the weather, there'll be torrential showers and thunderstorms across England and Wales, with more persistent rain across northern England, Cornwall and parts of northeast Scotland. Fewer showers for Northern Ireland and western Scotland, with sunny spells. That's the latest BBC News. The time is 2 minutes past one.
And time for today's early music show, presented by Catherine Bott.
Oh, Trio from an Italian comic opera showing a two-timing man, or is he, getting his comeuppance from two women. Mario Cecchetti as the character Learco is the unlucky chap, and Monica Gonzalez as Ergilda and Gabriella Letalkis as Dorisbe are the two women persecuting him, with the Savaria Baroque Orchestra directed by Fabio Pirona. And the opera concerned is Gustavo Primo by Baldassare Galuppi. Galuppi is the subject of today's early music show, and I'm absolutely delighted to be joined in the studio by an unashamed Galuppi partisan, the writer and critic Jonathan Keats, who is not only going to tell me more than I could possibly dream of knowing about Galuppi and his interesting life and why we should be rating him more highly than he seems to be generally rated, but he's also chosen all the music for today's programme from his very own collection. So before we start, and I'll let you get a word in edgeways now, Jonathan, thank you very much in advance. Tell me what is going on in Gustavo Primo, and is poor Learco ever going to get his just desserts?
The extraordinary thing about Gustavo Primo is that it's an opera in which the title character doesn't actually appear. He is simply mentioned all the way through the opera. He's an offstage figure, and the action all takes place at one remove from the title character. They're all hoping for Gustavus Vasa of Sweden to get the throne, but in the meantime, all sorts of comic amorous intrigues are going on stage.
Galuppi the composer, I know you are inclined to think that his comic opera is just about the finest there is.
I wouldn't go so far as that, but
oh, go on, be controversial.
Pretty near as damn it, yes. He is really the link between comic opera in its earliest 18th century form and the wonderful operas of Mozart and Rossini. Galuppi invented, devised the great end of act extended finales in which a whole lot happens and numbers are crammed together so that there are a whole series of different movements in different rhythms, and it nearly always ends with the characters expressing their different emotions in total confusion. We're very familiar with this from Rossini. We're also familiar with this in something like the party scene in Le Nozze di Figaro, etc., etc. But he couldn't do it on his own. He had to have a good librettist, Carlo Goldoni. He brought Venetian life onto the stage. He placed terrific stress on characterization. He preferred characterization to situations. And out of Goldoni's characterization come these really flesh and blood figures in opera who are not perfect. That was the thing that Goldoni understood about these human beings, that everybody has a few spots and blemishes, and you can actually make opera out of the spots and blemishes. And he and Galuppi were an absolutely winning combination. They thought the world of each other. They thought each other was the absolute genius bar none. Goldoni said at one point, whoever listens to the little man from Burano, Galuppi's nickname, whoever listens to Il Buranello has to stand still and take off his hat to a genius.
Well, let's return to Gustavo Primo, which is one of his earliest operas, isn't it?
Yes, it is. It's really the earliest really important Galuppi-Goldoni collaboration.
Well, we're going to hear an aria for the character of Ernesto, Can you just explain very briefly what is happening to Ernesto at this point? We haven't heard from him so far.
Ernesto is a curious thing. He is a castrato father. You might think that was oxymoronic, and there are not that many castrati fathers in opera.
He's the first one I've ever heard of, Jonathan, I have to admit.
And he's singing to his son, Learco, the bad boy, indeed, of the earlier piece, about how very disappointed he is in his behaviour.
Thank you. disappointed castrato father, that strange character from Opera Buffa, sung, just to confuse you, by a fully female singer, Edith Caroli, in that aria from Gustavo Primo, one of the first great operas where Galuppi combined with Goldoni. Jonathan, tell me about his upbringing in Burano.
Burano was a very special place. It was the lace-making island of the Venetian Republic. Like the glass island, Murano, the secrets of the lace-making were very, very closely guarded by the Republic. Nowadays, the lace is, most of it, made in factories in China. But in those days, it was made by women sitting at their doorways with a pillow called a tombola, where they made this very, very fine lace, which was coveted all over Europe. It was called Point de Venise, or in England, Venice Point. Then, at the end of the 17th century, some wicked Frenchmen stole the industrial secrets and the lace-making industry started to go downhill. They still make a bit of lace there now. In this world, young Galuppi grew up and showed prodigious musical talent.
His father was a barber slash violinist,
I read. There were lots of people who doubled as barbers and musicians. It was a kind of trade that you could combine, and so it was quite convenient to have that to fall back on.
And Galuppi wrote his first opera at the age of 16.
Yes. He studied with one of the greatest composers of early 18th century Venice, who was Antonio Lotti. Lotti and his wife, a singer called Santa Stella, had had great success in Dresden, but they came back to Venice, and Lotti worked at St. Mark's. While he was in Dresden, he was a friend of Handel, in fact, and there's quite a sort of cross-fertilisation between Lotti and Handel, and he was undoubtedly the best teacher for somebody like Galuppi.
We're going to have next music, a movement from a keyboard concerto. So he obviously was, as you say, very gifted in all departments.
He was a very, very good keyboard player and an extremely good keyboard composer. The keyboard concerto was in its relative infancy during the early to mid-18th century. Various composers contributed to it in different ways, Handel's organ concertos, for example. And Galuppi wrote about 8 or 9 of these keyboard concertos at various times during his life. And this is a particularly sparkling and attractive one. Thank you.
harpsichordist Massimiliano Raschietti with L'Opera Stravagante, directed by Ivano Zanenghi, in a movement from a keyboard concerto in F by Galuppi. With me in the studio today for the Early Music Show is Jonathan Keats, writer and critic. Now, let's talk about him going to London, because Burano, born, Venetian bred, it's in his veins.
Yes.
But he did have a year studying in Florence when he was very young and working in Florence.
Yes.
And he got taken up in 1741 to go to London for 2 years. So he was here.
Yes, he
what
was
did he
indeed.
Do in London?
He was writing operas. There was a kind of anyone but Handel feeling. And they were desperate to get the latest new sounds from particularly Venice or the sort of Venetian ambit. And young Galuppi came to London and produced a number of operas, not particularly successfully. Handel was very snooty about one of them called Penelope. He said in French, cette Penelope n'est qu'une salope. This Penelope is just a tart. But nevertheless, Handel did not scorn to pick up ideas from Galuppi. In the great oratorio Jephtha, there is a beautiful duet for the heroine Iphis and her lover Hamor, which is modelled on a serenata by Galuppi and is written in this very modern and frankly un-Handelian style. And that's Handel the Magpie, picked up from the man he scorned.
Which, of course, we must remind ourselves, was not in Handel and Galuppi's day thievery and dishonesty, but a huge compliment.
Yes, it was rather a compliment. Yes. Yeah.
Another thing that Handel and Galuppi had in common was brilliance in writing chamber cantatas, solo cantatas.
Yes. I mean,
and here we're going to have an aria from the cantata La Scusa, sung by Sara Mingardo, who's a name well known to the Early Music Show listeners. And what's this cantata all about?
This is a late cantata written in 1780, in which basically the lover is reconciling himself with a mistress with whom he's quarrelled. And this aria is particularly fascinating because it so much, I won't say foreshadows Mozart, but it has a distinctly classical quality to it. It's very obviously the late Galuppi style in its most seductive and beautiful form.
mezzo-soprano Sara Mingarda with l'opera Stravagante, directed by Ivano Zanenghi, in an aria Torna in quell'onda chiara from the cantata La Scusa by Baldassare Galluppi. You're listening to The Early Music Show with me, Catherine Bott, and with me in the studio today is writer and critic Jonathan Keats. And we're talking about Galluppi, and quite frankly, if you're not utterly convinced to go out and buy lots of Galluppi CDs after you've heard Jonathan, then you need your ears syringing. St. Mark's, Venice. Now, anybody who worked in music in Venice wanted to get a job there at some point, and he did, didn't he?
He did, indeed. He became master of the music at St. Mark's, and he seems to have been an extremely efficient music master. He took over, with the assistance of another composer called Latilla, the whole choir and orchestra, and gave it a right regular shakedown and sorted out the whole apparatus and improved the sound of the choir and the orchestra no end. And for St. Mark's, Galluppi wrote several major sacred pieces, one of which is this wonderful Credo, which is in a way like a cantata in itself. It's a sort of self-contained piece. It has episodes, incidents in it, and it's a very good illustration of what people like to think of as Galuppi's learning. They like the feeling that occasionally, even in Italy, where the stress was so much on opera, there was an appreciation of the learned or scientific qualities of the composer. And Galuppi's science is hugely impressive in this piece.
Thank you.
The Credo from the Mass for St. Mark from 1766 by Galluppi. The singers were soprano Patrizia Vaccari, altos Roberto Balconi and Nicola Marchesini, with the Athestis Chorus and the Accademia degli Musici, conducted by Filippo Maria Bressan. I'm hearing a very worldly cast in that music. I mean, in Venice, there's no Mother Julian of Venice, is there?
No, there isn't. No. No. The paradox at the heart of Venetian life, really, was that you had this city which made a terrific song and dance about being Catholic, but the religious aspect of life in the city was largely performance. It was largely putting on shows, because that's what Venetians loved. And Venice was always quarrelling with the Pope. During the course of his life, Galuppi had two stints as a choirmaster, and composer at one of the amazing girls' orchestra hospitals, as they were called. These were, in fact, orphanages where young girls and young women played all the instruments in the orchestra. And they were so virtuoso that people would come not just from Venice, but sometimes from far afield to hear these legendary performers. Vivaldi, of course, wrote concertos, many concertos for them.
Well, this is fascinating because I assumed that, you know, Vivaldi had the monopoly on girls' hospital virtuosi, but Galuppi was in there too.
Galuppi was in there too. Several other key Venetian composers were, and Galuppi himself provided a whole sequence of fantastic sacred pieces for his choir and orchestra.
Well, let's just put a few factoids in and say that it was 1762 when he became Maestro di Cappella at St. Mark's. Only 3 years later, he got himself 3 years' leave to go to Russia to be Catherine the Great's chapel musical director, where he contributed quite a lot of stuff to the Orthodox Church.
Yes, that was something which the composers who went there were expected to do. Catherine cherry-picked the best Italian composers throughout her long reign. She'd grown up in a small, music-loving German court. She was herself German. She was very fond of music. And the opera in Moscow and St. Petersburg and the royal palaces was controlled, directed and provided by a whole sequence of great Italian composers, including Cimarosa, Paisiello and Galuppi. And now and then they were called upon to provide music for the Russian Orthodox Church.
One does rather like to think of Russian aristocrats all speaking French and listening to Italian music.
Yes, which is what happened.
Well, he managed to parlay his stay in Russia out to 5 years instead of the agreed three. But then he did return in 1768 to St. Mark's and the Hospital for Incurables. But gradually he turned away from the theatre and really began to focus on keyboard music.
Galuppi wrote about 130 keyboard sonatas. He is the next big thing, really, as a keyboard composer after Scarlatti. And he consolidated and developed the keyboard sonata in a fascinating variety of ways. There is an astonishing range of expression in the sonatas. You could do a programme alone on the variety of the keyboard sonatas. But this one is more like a kind of fantasia. It has a kind of free-flowing, improvisatory element in it, the sense that a fantasia is at various points trying to get into the body of the sonata and not really succeeding. It's a very, very strong single-movement work.
Thank you. Well, whether he sat stately or not, that was Luca Guglielmi playing the harpsichord, the sonata in G minor, opus 2, number 3, by Galuppi. I'm fairly convinced, Jonathan, listening to you, that could you be transported back in time, you'd have got on very well with Charles Burney, because he liked Galuppi too, didn't he?
He did indeed, yes. He very much admired the underlying structural strength of Galuppi's music. He knew that it wasn't just smoke and mirrors, it wasn't just froth, but underlying it there was this very taut musical structure, that he was a great builder of music. Burney was a roaring snob. His poor daughter, Fanny, suffered from that, being forced to become lady-in-waiting to Queen Charlotte. And so Burney's judgment of Galuppi is conditioned by the fact that Burney thought he was really quite a gentleman. And that sort of judgment is somehow typical of Burney. You have all these terrific comments about the composer, but then, you know, Burney gives him the final brownie point, that he had a certain air of the gentleman about him.
Well, Galuppi may or may not have been a gentleman, but he certainly died quite a wealthy man, didn't he?
Yes, he did.
Well stricken in years.
Yes, Signora Galuppi was left really quite comfortably off, which is not the case in a great many composers' wives, particularly of that period. And so Galuppi, really, we could say, if we were on Burano and looking back on him, the boy done good.
Well, the boy done particularly good opera, and we're going to end with a finale. But
yes.
My finale for today's Early Music Show is to thank you, Jonathan Keats, for coming into the studio today and sharing your passion for this man and his music. Let's go very quickly into the finale, Spiriti Erranti from La Diavolessa. Got 1, 2, 3, 4 singers, and what has happened to them all?
What has happened is that they're fortune hunters. Two of them are fortune hunters, and they believe that they can persuade Don Popone to give up his treasure by using mock or fake enchantments to persuade him to give it up. And they're complete frauds. It's a typical Goldoni situation, and Popone falls for it, absolutely.
Oh, diavolone, oh che brutto diavolone. Oh, che bella diavolina,
principiate a lavorare.
Questo qui, dal monirar, questo qui, dal monirar.
Via cavane, seguitate, la lezione che sa da far, la lezione che sa da far.
Finale of Baldassare Galuppi's opera La Diavolessa. Tom Allen as Falco, Matthias Fivek as Giannino, Kramena Dilcheva as Dorina and Ekbert Junghans as Don Popone. And it ends today's Early Music Show, which was produced in Salford by Les Pratt. And you can, if you wish, download a podcast version of the programme from the BBC Radio 3 website. Just follow the links to the Early Music Show pages. Glancing ahead to tomorrow's programme, Catherine will be exploring the musical elements of the lavish funeral of the 16th century Anne of Brittany, an event that lasted 40 days. That's at the same time, just after 1 o'clock.
A composer renowned for choral music that's winning ever wider audiences. On BBC Radio 3, Eric Whittaker makes his proms debut in a late-night showcase for which the BBC singers join forces with his own vocal ensemble. The programme includes Whittaker's new work inspired by the Olympic motto, Citius Altius Fortius, faster, higher, stronger. Eric Whittaker at the BBC Proms on Radio 3 this Wednesday night at 10:15.
Well, now it's 2 o'clock and time for our repeat of last Monday's Proms Chamber Music Concert. The presenter was Clemency Burton Hill.
Hello and welcome to Cadogan Hall for today's Chamber Prom, which comes courtesy of the young New York-based ensemble, the Escher Quartet. Formed in 2005, violinists Adam Barnett Hart and Wu Ji, viola player Pierre Lapointe and cellist Dane Johansson also joined the BBC New Generation Artists Scheme 2 years ago, during which time they've explored a wealth of repertoire from Elgar to Zemlinsky. Today we're going to hear them perform Debussy as part of a proms-wide celebration of the 150th anniversary of his birth. Before that, though, we're going to hear Hugh Wood's String Quartet No. 4 in conjunction with the Royal Philharmonic Society's Encore scheme, which champions contemporary works that haven't had an outing in a while and which definitely deserve a new audience. Now, this quartet was written in 1993 but has never previously been heard at the proms, and I'm delighted to say that Hugh Wood, the composer himself, is in the audience with us here at Cadogan Hall this lunchtime, and he's agreed to tell us a little bit more about this work. Hugh, it's wonderful to have you here.
Well, thank you. It's nice to be here.
This work was a bit of a return to the conventional string quartet form for you. What can we expect?
Yes, it was. Four movements which are sort of faintly linked but fall into traditional bits, a sort of introductory movement, scherzo, one of many that I've written really, slow movement, and the finale is sort of climactic. And the point is that once you've heard the rather aggressive material with which it starts, you'll meet that and various other bits again, because they're all sort of integrated.
Well, it's interesting that you use the word aggressive, because I was talking to members of the Escher Quartet earlier and they were saying that one of the things that really, really surprised them about this work, and they've absolutely loved learning the language, they say, was that they were expecting this work from a British composer such as yourself to have a lot more British reserve, they said. They thought it would be rather nostalgic or pastoral, and in actual fact, they described it as very energetic, very determined, and said that they really felt that there were influences in there from the likes of Schoenberg to Elliot Carter. Do you agree with that assessment?
Well, I'm flattered by the Elliot Carter. I pinched an idea of his, which is to have an idea of having a quite long cadenza for the leader, the first violin, very early in the piece. And if you look at Elliot Carter's first quartet, that's exactly what he does. No, I have news for the Americans. There are a few Brits who are aware of Schoenberg, but alas, no, we're a diminishing bunch because we're all getting terribly old.
Hardly, you're looking very sprightly, but we should say also happy birthday, Hugh, because I know you celebrated your birthday in June.
Yes, that's right, yes. People are not so, it's a bit old-fashioned to be as fond of Schoenberg as I am.
Very briefly, I know there was another influence on this work.
Yes, there was. While we're on Schoenberg, I read somewhere, to my great surprise, that one of his quartets, and composer's testimony on this, was not actually in origin as abstract as he thought, and the original thought came through memories of reading a children's adventure story when he was a child, of a shipwreck at sea, and that's behind the third quartet. It sounds unlikely, but it does embolden me to tell you what I've never told anyone before, which is I'm very fond of a poem by Tennyson called Ulysses, in which Ulysses, back from all his journeys and adventures, settled down in his kingdom, decides to have one last bash and to go seafaring once again and have just one last lot of adventures. And I've always been very touched by this poem, and that's what I sort of felt like at the time. Forgive me if I read the last half dozen lines from it, because they could serve as an epigraph for what I was trying to do in the piece. This sounds terribly po-faced, but still, never mind. He writes, though much is taken, much abides, and though we are not now that strength which in old days moved earth and heaven, that which we are, we are. One equal temper of heroic hearts, made weak by time and fate, but strong in will to strive, to seek, to find, and not to yield.
Stirring words. Thank you so much, Hugh. Now to hear your string quartet number 4. Please welcome to the stage the Escher Quartet. Thank you.